The exciting thing about that is when people think about serving, they think, I need to do more. I need to go above and beyond. I need to go out of my way. But what you're actually saying is serving is doing the right things.
Yeah.
Well, not doing more of everything.
Yes. Beautifully said. That's right. Because it is oftentimes simpler and calmer. It's not just more. Love that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Marketing Blender Show. Today, I'm your host, Daisy McCarty, and we have our special guest, Blender CEO, Dacia Coffey, and she's here to talk about her book, Corporate Caffeine, and this is a book about boosting B2B growth through sales and marketing alignment. Welcome to the show, Dacia.
I love this. This is so fun and funny all at the same time, so thank you.
I should say welcome to your show.
I know, right?
But today you do get to talk all about yourself and about your work, but most importantly about the impact that this book can have. So the first question I want to ask is, why did you write Corporate Caffeine?
Thank you for that question. Because people tick me off. No, I mean, I'm being a little bit funny, but honestly, when people think about their businesses, they operationalize their operations, their delivery. They operationalize financials. They operationalize almost everything. But then when it comes to marketing, maybe we should try this. Maybe we should try this. Like, and they chase. And it literally sets marketing up for failure. But also, I feel that marketing is one of the most under-leveraged tools in the business-to-business landscape. I mean, our communication is so important. Aligning with sales is so important. Aligning with the entire business model is so important. And growth doesn't have to be as hard as B2B makes it. And so I really wrote this book, number one, to show some fundamental true principles about how to accelerate revenue. That's what we do. We grow companies. But number two, it's because when you embed a heart of servant leadership in alignment and unity into your marketing, it ends up pervading culture. And wow, now your differentiation is actually walking the walk. It's not just the bullet points of why your mousetrap is better. It's literally why and how you are an organization of excellence and how you create dramatic transformation in the world. That is worthy of what marketing should be communicating, not, well, we're better, faster, cheaper. No, nobody cares about that. So I just want marketing and the words and the symbols and the representations that we use to literally reflect and honor the work that these great companies do, create a little bit more sanity doing it. So yeah, definitely a heart project for me, despite the fact that this book is incredibly practical. I mean, it is literally, this is what you do. Step one, step two. I mean, it's very, you know, a heart project.
It is. And I like the fact that there's no fluff in it. I've read it a couple times so far, and it's going to make you stop and think. It's not, oh, I just flipped through it and I got the gist of what it was. It is every single chapter, there's something that people should be doing based on what they're reading. But at the same time, it's not overwhelming. And that brings me to my second question. Obviously, marketers are going to look at this book and say, if I'm in the B2B space, I need to read this.
Right.
But who else should be reading it? It's not just for marketers, is it?
No. You know, the two big ones, leadership and ownership, should be reading this. And it doesn't matter what size company. There is no company so big that they can afford to waste money on marketing and hope things work instead of plan for success. And the reason why I want leadership, even if they are no longer in the business development role or if they're not heading up business development, it's because CEOs sniper marketing and sales success on accident all the time, all the time. And we, both of us, speak to large groups of very seasoned marketers. And I don't know about you, but those audiences are ticked off. Like when, yeah, you know, when we're doing a keynote or something. And the reason is because, you know, like leadership can say, we need to fill the pipeline. We need sales leads. We need quality leads. Great, great. But then they say, we want to be thought leaders. We want to reach the masses. Oh no, those are in very, very different places of a marketing plan. And guess what a marketer is going to do at the end of the day? They're going to give the boss what he wants. And so there's so many times when we see success and, you know, well thought out planning skewered by, you know, the different limbs of leadership because they don't really realize that what they're asking has a very specific change in what the focus and where the resources are being planned for the growth of the company. So you know, that is a really big reason. And then you and I both talk about this a lot, that marketing can and should help to secure and enrich the culture of the company. So definitely there's a lot of leadership principles in here about communication, whether it's one-to-one or you to your organization or your organization to the market. They're the same human principles around how do we make decisions, how do we engage with information, and how do we decide to act upon that. So definitely a leadership book. And heads of sales.
Yes, I was going to ask that question. Why should B2B salespeople read this book? And what are they going to get out of it that they just had no idea about before?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, we agree that marketing should fill the pipeline. Absolutely. So marketing and sales should be best friends. And what I try to do is I try to untangle the spaghetti of why then does this divorce keep happening between sales and marketing? So I think for sales leaders and salespeople, they'll understand, you know, the mechanics of what marketing can do to make their jobs easier. But then also there's supposed to be this really smooth handoff. And so understanding what that handoff looks like, and even messaging choreography, so the psychology of decision-making can be incredibly fun and impactful for salespeople, because there's a lot of things that they can apply in their follow-up emails and how they structure a deck when they present, and even choreographing the close to make it actually a really amazing experience for a prospect. And who doesn't want that? Who doesn't want, when you're trying to get a contract signed, for your prospect to be more excited to sign on the line than even you are? Let's go. And that's what we're talking about, is really delighting humans and being human together and getting on the same side of the table with our prospects, because they want to engage with us, which of course accelerates revenue growth. So yeah.
And just as a quick note, you can find Corporate Caffeine on Amazon. It's available here in this lovely paperback. It's available on Kindle. And of course, it's available on Audible.
Finally,
we're so excited, so that you can listen to it while you're on your commute. You can listen to it on the treadmill. You can get your marketing and sales alignment fix wherever you go.
And wow, that was weird to listen to myself read my own words. That was so strange. And for the record, this will not surprise you, I'm a fast talker. So I might be one of the few audibles where you actually slow it down.
You weren't going to listen to you on 1.5?
No, definitely not. I will absolutely be a chipmunk at that rate.
All right. So I wanted to dive into some of my favorite excerpts from the book. So I'm going to read those, and then I'd like to have a conversation around them.
Okay. I love it.
All right. So the first one really dives into why do this at all? And is it about selling or is it about serving? How do you approach your market and what's your goal? So the first item is on being of service. Your prospective customer is on a path to solve a problem. Your team is progressing one deal at a time to a total sales goal. Your marketing and business communication is supposed to provide tools to guide both parties on their shared pilgrimage. But customers and companies alike are getting lost along the way. In our busyness, we easily forget to fulfill our promise to help others get what they want when we're engaged in communication. So what happens when companies do put their customers at the center of what they do?
Oh, gosh. Okay. I think some people are going to be so excited to hear this. They will turn off waste. There are a lot of things that we see teams asking for. Give us more case studies. Give us more of this. You know, maybe we should do a webinar. And when you put your prospect at the center and you think to yourself and your team thinks to themselves together, well, how does this person enjoy buying? What do they need in order to create progress for them and their companies? And that's really what B2B sales is about, is creating progress towards the solution to a significant problem that buyer has. Then you start thinking, okay, well, how are they researching? What kind of questions? What do they need to feel confident? What kind of consensus do they have to build? And you will start to realize that several of the tactics that you do may or may not be necessary. You'll also start to realize they may or may not be in the right place at the right time, because you can say something brilliant, and if you put it at the wrong place of the buyer's journey, it just doesn't matter, because they're not there yet, because you're not walking alongside of them. You're trying to either fast forward, or your fear and your desire to land them as a client is overwhelming them. It's the number one reason we get ghosted. So really, we start seeing sales cycles shorten. We see higher return on investment. We see clearer decision making. And we really start making decisions in a way that just says, well, everybody loves to buy, but they hate to be sold, is what we're offering to them, really creating progress towards a purchase, which then enables them to strengthen their organization. And see the difference? Like, it's calm. Like, it's exciting. It's honorable. It's not, oh my gosh, we should do digital ads. Maybe we should do social media. Well, how do we attribute social media to a single sale? Well, what about that email? Or maybe we should buy a list. Oh, good God. There is no servant leadership in the center of that. So I think number one, it makes it more effective because you're really personalizing. But number two, wow, like, it's energizing for a team to really be using their work to go, we are really helping another business person be successful in their career and in the organization. Let's go, you know?
The exciting thing about that is when people think about serving, they think, I need to do more. I need to go above and beyond. I need to go out of my way. But what you're actually saying is serving is doing the right things.
Yeah.
Well said. Not doing more of everything.
Yes. Beautifully said. That's right. Because it is oftentimes simpler and calmer. It's not just more. Love that. Are you a CEO of a business-to-business company? Maybe you're a sales leader or a salesperson, or maybe you're in business-to-business marketing. Well, if so, I wrote a book for you, and it's called Corporate Caffeine. Business-to-business marketing is different, but there are certain predictable fundamental principles that will help you unleash your organizational potential and fill your pipeline sustainably. So you can find my book on Audible, on Amazon, on barnesandnoble.com, or any of your favorite retailers. Hope you enjoy it, and I'd love to hear your feedback.
All right. So let's talk about who is in control, because this is a big, big stumbling block for B2B companies that feel like they're losing access to the decision-making process. Buyers now control the research portion of the sales cycle. Thus, your brand recognition, digital marketing, and content, i.e. your marketing, will be what earn you a seat at the table. However, even for those who have brand recognition, digital marketing, and content, it's never been more difficult to be memorable and unique and to be heard, desired, and trusted. Talk to me about how this problem is showing up for the businesses that you talk to and how it's impacting their sales.
So I think in B2B, you know, these are complicated selling environments. I mean, these are extremely smart people selling to other extremely smart people. And we have all worked so hard to be smart and to be good at what we are good at. I think first things first, there's no brownie points anymore for being good at your thing. It doesn't matter how brilliant you are in finance or manufacturing or widgets or aerospace or human resources or consulting. It doesn't matter. Like, you're supposed to be great at your thing nowadays. That's what people expect. And so getting lost in the details of how you believe you're differentiated sounds very different in your head than it does to a buyer's. So really, it goes back to what we were just talking about, that servant leadership component. Where are they getting lost? How can you create information where they are engaging? And I will beat this drum to death. Marketing, B2B marketing, is supposed to create progress for a human being that is facing a problem in their lives, in their career, in their business. And so what do they need to learn first? Not why you're better, why you're being compared to your competitors. What do they need to learn first? Like, if you were giving your best friend information and advice about, okay, here's what you need to understand about my industry in making this decision, what would it sound like? And then do that, right? Because we do have to just respect that we are all so busy, your prospects are so busy, they have to protect their time. And so that means Googling how they want to, talking to their referral sources, so whether it's their CPA or their CEO coach or their peers or going to an industry conference, where do they feel confident getting information? Where do they have the capacity and the capability to receive information? I mean, everything now has to be about them. In the statistics 10, 15 years ago, we're saying people were 60% of the way through their business decision before engaging with a salesperson. Now the studies are suggesting 80 to 90%. So that basically means they've pre-decided who they're going to buy from, and then they're just humoring two out of the three of you. You know, so they have confirmation bias. I do believe that you can still win. You, as the underdog, if you have not done the marketing and the prep, I believe you can still win. principles in this book will help you do that. However, everything has changed. The consultative selling from the 1990s, where we were all taught, sit down, do a discovery session. No, no one has time for that. So you have to assume and presume around your subject matter expertise, you understand this environment, you understand these decision makers, you understand what they're struggling with, and then start in the middle of the conversation when you finally are having a belly-to-belly conversation, because they've already progressed. You should also assume where they're going to be at and really continue to help them along that journey. So it is a completely different paradigm. The good thing is it makes your extremely expensive salespeople way more effective because they get to spend more time serving and closing deals, not dialing for dollars and, you know, going to be a hunter. There's very few hunters in general anyways, and nowadays they're just not as effective. So
you just heard Dacia say that today's buyers are 80 to 90% of the way through their decision-making process before they talk to a salesperson. The thing that catches my attention about that is most of the B2B teams that we talk to are 10, 20, 30 salespeople and maybe one person in marketing. Is it an appropriate spend to have that many salespeople who are dealing with the final 10 to 20% of the journey and only one person or only a tiny part of your budget allocated to getting people 80% of the way there?
You know, I don't know if you're going to bring this up later, but the other thing, like that, what you're talking about there brings up such an important point. The sales superstars are not a little better than everyone else. They are eons, leaps and bounds better. That Pareto's principle that 20% is making up 80% of your success, 20% of your sales team is typically responsible for as much as 80% of your deals and your clients. And what if they get poached? Right? So we're not advocating, oh, cut your sales team, but we are advocating, let's be thoughtful about what are the leading indicators, the activities that they should be responsible for, and what can marketing soak up in order to fill the pipeline so that they are more effective. Because I love you pointing out that ratio right there. I mean, that should be a, ooh, is the year 2024? Yeah, is that appropriate?
Anyway? We'll definitely be talking about budgeting in a minute. Yeah. But next step, we're going to talk about why the marketing department should be called the sanitation department, and it's because of the amount of waste. So I know this is one of your favorite drums to beat on. This is about stop wasting money. So there are really only two reasons that clients ever hire me to help them with their marketing. One, to end the frustration of not growing revenue as fast as they should be, and two, to stop the feeling that they are wasting their marketing money on ineffective tactics. So how do you address marketing waste effectively? And is there some kind of magic bullet, or is it a more involved process?
Oh, gosh. Definitely the more involved process. No magic bullets except consistency in marketing. And great questions. You know, the quality of your question leads to the quality of your answer. So I think those questions that lead you on the right path are huge. So those are the only magic bullets. But wow, when it comes to wasting money in marketing, it's just prevalent. And I think it's because the blind spot people are sitting in is, well, we've always done that. We've always gone to that trade show, or we've always wined and dined clients this way, or we're scared to change or turn on or off said ad spend. Doesn't matter if it's in trade publication or if it is in digital marketing. People just keep doing the things that they've always been doing. FOMO, even when you're getting zero, is a real thing. And so I would argue that we might be the most numbers-oriented marketing agency on the planet, but it's about starting with the numbers. First and foremost, build your revenue growth number. And when I say build, I mean, what are the assumptions that, you know, on how you're going to hit $1 million, $5 million, $10 million in growth this year? What is that? So is it coming from client, you know, in customer retention, cross-sells and upsells? There is strategy behind that. You shouldn't just hope for that. You should literally map out that number. Okay, great. There's a portion and people should be accountable for that. And we need to figure out, does marketing play a role in your customer strategies? It should. But then when we get to net new, break it down. Is there different divisions? Is there different products? It doesn't really matter what the semantics inside of a company is, but your average deal size, great. So if you have a $5 million net new business, what's the average deal size of that? Divide those two. So for instance, if you're one of those companies where your average deal size is $1 million and you have a $5 million revenue growth, that is five projects. It's less than you think. A lot of times, because people hear the number 5 million, they're like, we have to do 5 million bits of work to get to that. No, no. There are real human beings behind that, right? And so breaking that down, because when you have five, that literally changes the marketing planning structure of how do we go get five very difficult, very high cognitive load deals versus what if that was very different and the number was we need 500 new projects or customers. Okay, now a one-to-many strategy is very different. So first and foremost, the numbers dictate where we go. Second, those numbers have to support the leads. What are your lead sources, right? So you and I talk a lot about, and really this book helped me crystallize this thinking around a system and an ecosystem. So marketing should always be progressing towards a systematized, operationalized approach, right? So what system are we building? Which means, what is the predictable or forecastable output, quality leads or meetings or proposals that are coming from your different aspects? But not every single tool is your final product for lead generation. So social media is a great example. 5-10 years ago, people found companies on social media. I would argue that does not happen without paid anymore. But now we see it heavily influencing the sales process, you know, pushing on that social proof, activating referral partners, you know, really building consensus. And so showing you are who you say you are. So we've seen social media move. So you can't turn off social media. You need to exist. You need to have a voice. You need to have a lot of proof points. But for most of our clients, is there a direct attribution between a single social media post and the overall growth? Not a direct one. But in the ecosystem, an important one, as long as you know the role and the goal. So I'm talking a lot about numbers, but I want people to be thinking this critically about how they approach. And when you go back to your buyers, if they do not go to LinkedIn, I don't care that you're in B2B. You don't have to be on LinkedIn. If your buyers, now I would argue there's not very many of those. However, if your buyers are not on LinkedIn, you don't need to waste your time. TikTok. I don't care how big it's growing. You don't have to be on TikTok if your buyers are never going to be on TikTok. If your buyers no longer go to trade shows, you don't have to go to those trade shows. And so just starting to think about what's the role and the goal and then matching it to the expectations and building systems behind each of those to either hit the benchmark, optimize in order to hit the benchmark, or kill it if we realize the data showing us our buyers are simply not responding in this environment. So did I just make that terribly confusing? I get so excited about this part. It's easier to show on a whiteboard and in a spreadsheet, though, sure, than talking it out. But it is being practical around marketing. Like, marketing's creative and fun, but doggone it, it's also serious. It's supposed to do something important for your company.
It should. So you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. One of the top reasons to read Corporate Caffeine is to figure out how to stop wasting money. One of the very first things we do here with our clients at Blender is switch stuff off. We cut marketing spend, and then we show you how to spend correctly and how to spend appropriately to reach your goals.
Yeah. One of the craziest stories that we had was we worked with a client, and we write their marketing plan. Everybody's excited. We've done the numbers, right? And then week after week, when we're meeting with their in-house marketing team, they're not completing the milestones. Now, we had total buy-in. These milestones are reasonable. You have the time allocation. These are priority from leadership all the way down. These have to get done this quarter, week after week after week, kicking it down. So finally, we go, what is going on? Why are you not hitting these milestones? And side note, director of marketing, I mean, this is your career. Like, everyone is watching this and you're not progressing. And it was because she didn't turn off any of the activities that she was doing. So she decided to keep everything she had been doing before and add on. And so they were wasting more money and slagging behind, you know, the progress they should have been made. And it was that moment, just that aha around, all right, now we need to start asking the question, okay, tell me what you are doing and being very, very clear we will not do press releases anymore. We will not do this trade show anymore. We will not chase this chaos anymore because you're getting zero return on investment for it. Your busyness is not progressing the company. You need to shift. And so it is a big gear shift. But that moment when we realized she'd kept all of her tasks, it was hard.
Yes, wasting time is even more dangerous than wasting money. Yeah. Because you cannot get it back no matter what you
do. Yeah, exactly. Brilliant young woman and just so scared to not keep doing all the things that had kept her employed prior to that instead of focusing on impact.
For sure. So next we get to talk about buyer personas. And we do a lot of work around this because we talk to B2B companies and they know their firmographics. You know, they know what industry they want to sell to, what size of company, maybe some of the titles. And when we get down deeper than that, things get really gray and fuzzy. Yeah. So what you have to say about developing buyer personas was this: to create resonant messaging, to build a highly effective marketing plan, and to stand out in a sea of sameness, we must place the humanity of our buyers at the center of our business development approach. You simply do not have the money, time, and attention to reach everyone. So how do you identify and define your ideal buyer? And does it go beyond just what filters you might use on a advertising platform?
Great question. I love this. I'm actually going to throw this back at you to, you know, for a couple of great examples because you've got so many interesting ones. But yeah, absolutely. So I love to make sure that we get the best client-facing people in a room together. And it doesn't matter what aspect of the company, right? So we want marketing, we want sales, we want leadership. If you have a customer service rep, if you have a field manager, if you have anybody that knows these humans that you serve really, really well, get them in the room. This is typically for a small company, you know, as few as 1 to 3 people. For a larger company, it's rarely bigger than 12, right? But small group of people talking. And we start talking about who are the titles. Typically, that's where it starts, right? In the industries. And we just blackboard it or whiteboard it, you know, who are the different ones. But then we need to start talking about, well, who can say yes? Because a lot of people can say no. So frequently we'll see 7, 8, 9 buyer personas, you know, the titles and just, you know, some rough sketches of them in quick format. We'll see a number of them. But when we start saying, can they say yes? Can they sign the check? Are they the final owner? Oftentimes they get turned off. And occasionally that person has so much influence that they're the mouthpiece for the person who has to say yes. So they are the buyer persona. But getting everybody in the room and talking that out, it is amazing how quickly things calm down after those first 30, 45 minutes where we clearly see it written down. And everybody goes, oh, wow. Because a lot of times we see people trying to sell in to the wrong place and they don't actually hold the ownership, or they're not pushing on certain influencers, or they're not learning to build consensus. So many amazing opportunities. And so typically we do see, except for nonprofits, they're more complicated, but 3 to 4 buyer personas making up 90% of the success of that client and how revenue flows. And so then we start prioritizing. But, you know, I talked about the humanity. So great. That's who you spend money on. But you're right. Those are the targeting parameters if you're on LinkedIn or Facebook or anywhere else where you can actually enter demographic and sometimes psychographic information. So that's beneficial in digital marketing. But you do start mapping out, well, you know, these human beings, how do they spend their time, right? So busy female executive, if that's a buyer persona, woo, we do not send her emails at the end of the day. Because depending on where she is in her life cycle, she is probably trying to get home, trying to get to the kids. A lot of times these women are volunteering in their communities in addition to their executive careers, in addition to their family. And so really being thoughtful about what time she actually does have to spend and then really never wasting her time, you know. But also mirroring back to her and the messaging who she is, how difficult it is to be her, and just really being in it with her, you know, changing the tone of the message to reflect her reality versus that tiny little business decision that is huge for our clients. But in the whole universe of hers, it's just a small percentage of one of the gazillion decisions she has to make that week. And so there's just so many neat things that we can do. You know, some buyer personas we realize they don't Google. because they're too far in their careers and they're not going to find those answers for the, you know, sort of for senior level subject matter expert, engineering or architects or, you know, anybody like that. They're difficult questions. Google cannot answer those, no matter Professor Google, not going to be beneficial. So who does have enough influence to get them to answer those questions and progress, and how do they reach? And so a lot of times it looks very different what we activate in order to reach those senior level buyers, senior level decision makers. And another one I love is, okay, vice president of sales. You know when they check email? Saturday mornings before their kids' baseball games. Like, there have been a couple times where we activated a campaign intentionally to show up at 6:30 a.m. on a Saturday, and guess what? It worked, because we know he travels and he's always on the go and he doesn't get to clear his email until Saturday morning. And we're up top, and if we wrote an amazing subject line, he's going to read it because he's not being interrupted. So I don't know. Do you have any others that really pop to mind for you? Because there's so much creativity in when you decide to put a human at the center of your decisions, you can do so many amazing things to be kind to them, to excite them, to get their, you know, to get their attention.
I do. And this is one of the things I love about our work with buyer personas, is we go deeper than I've ever seen any other marketing agency go, because people come to me and they say, oh, we've done buyer personas, and they have some bullet points for us to look at. Yeah. So one of the questions that I always ask when we're going through a buyer persona deep dive is about philosophy. Mm. Like, what do they believe? And this is a question that's usually very difficult for people to answer at first.
Yes.
So one of the follow-up questions is, what makes them angry?
Love
and
that
this
question.
Is, this is one of your favorite questions. I got question. This one from you. And I was working with one of our participants in the Marketing Blender Lab, which is our program for small businesses and solopreneurs. And one of the participants is selling to meeting and event planners within large organizations.
Yeah, big deal.
And so we were talking about their pains and, you know, what the stressors are in their life, et cetera, et cetera. But then when I asked that what makes them angry question, she got down to the philosophy. She was like, well, when, you know, hotels do this, when suppliers aren't doing that. And what it came down to was, they believe that life should be fair, that things should be fair.
Yes.
So when we're talking to this persona about what winning looks like for them, this is not, you want to be a cutthroat negotiator, you want to walk away with the maximum amount of ROI. It's, you need someone on your side to make sure that this is fair for everyone.
Yeah.
And you can see there's a very clear distinction between how you would talk to, you know, a killer salesperson about what winning looks like, or a cutthroat executive who's like, I win if somebody else loses. That's a different messaging strategy than someone who just wants things to be fair.
That's
they
right.
want everybody to win. And that's it changes right. the language that you use, and it changes how you open conversations, and it changes how you position the value of what you offer. So doing that really deep dive into psychographics, what people care about and what they believe, will transform how you message to them.
Oh my gosh. Oh, there's so many good examples. I'm going to skip them because we have more conversation. But I love that one because, again, it's what's their heartbeat. And it's not about judging, right? You know, if you have a buyer persona that is win, win, win at all cost, okay, well, we serve them in that point of view, like align yes. with them. And, oh, good one. So good.
All right. So we're talking about helping buyers make progress, which brings us into the sales cycle. So you've got the buyer's journey from their perspective, and then you've got the sales journey from your perspective, and making sure there's alignment between the two is important. So this is what you had to say about mapping the sales cycle. The sales cycle has a sales point of view. In each phase, it instructs the action that the company or its representatives should take to bring in revenue, attract, build, close. These are all words that prioritize the seller. This perspective is not customer-centric. The answer is to put the customer in the center of the sales cycle and map out what the salesperson needs to provide as they journey together toward a decision. So you've touched on this, but I'd like a little bit of a deeper dive into, what does this sales cycle look like from the buyer's perspective, and why does that matter?
Yeah, such a great point. So I am a total word nerd. Semantics matter. Words communicate something very specific, even if it's only on a subconscious level. So I am very passionate about being thoughtful around, how do we organize our words when we're getting the team on the same page to serve the market? So great example of attract. Well, you want that, then immediately goes, oh, well, to me. So it tempts us to talk about us. What makes us attractive? What can I do to you know, beautify my company, wow, bedazzle, you know, sizzle, allure. But that's not what modern B2B marketing is about. People pay attention to themselves, especially when they're busy. So if they see something about a problem they're struggling with, they pay attention to that. If they see something that is naturally what they believe is funny, they pay attention to that because they're paying attention to signals in their environment that say, oh, this is about me. And so a buyer is going through that process where they're journeying through awareness, right? And so using words like helping them be aware of a problem or moving into awareness of their solutions, that's different. You know, now you're trying to, you know, share knowledge. You're trying to help them help themselves. And a lot of times awareness is not awareness that you exist or awareness that, you know, that you are a competitor, you know, or that you're better than someone else. Awareness often is their problem and every single way they could solve that problem. And you or your industry might only be one way. So, you know, those semantics are really important. And so, for instance, you know, building trust, you know, like stacking it, you know, it's more of a collaborative process and inviting someone to validate, are you who you say you are? And so just being really careful about how do we shift that.
So I know that you wrote in your book about messaging choreography, but instead of asking the question and letting you answer it here, everybody, if you want to understand what messaging choreography is and how to say the right thing at the right time so that you make that sales journey much, much shorter, please read the book Corporate Caffeine, and that will have the answers that you need. So next question is around marketing psychology. Do you want to know why your current marketing isn't working? Because you're not tapping into the most important tool in your marketing and in your humanity, your ability to create an emotional response in another person. B2B companies are horrible at doing this. Dry, bland, self-centered, dusty, ugly marketing. We see this all the time. And that doesn't attract anyone.
No, no. Why would it? I mean, our lives are already hard. Why make your marketing burdensome and heavy? I mean, we're in a war on attention with all the digital, with the phone, with the always on, always looking at our screens. Why would you just add to the noise? Just wah, wah, wah. No, cut through it with something resonant and important and significant for that person, right? So the psychology, you know, there's a relatively new area of study called behavioral economics. Finance is pretty comfortable with this. Marketing's gotten pretty comfortable. But most other industries, especially B2B, are not paying attention to this environment. And it's about how does the brain receive information. So two different things. Reticular activating system filters out, you know, is filtering 11 million bits of information per second. It's trying to keep most of it out. And so basically the brain at lightning speed is going, is that about me? Is that about me? Is that about me? Is that about me? Right? And just constantly elevating. And so the brain does not let anything in unless it is relevant to what the brain is already concerned about. That's why this principle, and the brain literally has something called mirror neurons, the principle of mirroring to people and talking to them about themselves so that they realize you specialize in them, that you understand what it's like to walk in their shoes, that you understand why it's difficult to make this decision or to make progress on this decision. Incredibly, incredibly effective. Also, it's the servant leadership point of view too. So it's respectful and honorable to work in that sort of way. And then progressing that person. You know, I mentioned earlier I was going to beat that drum. But when you work in the way that the brain works, you're creating progress, which engages critical thinking, which is getting a person to narrow their field of focus on you and track with you, like really start engaging with your information. That's a game changer, right? Instead of just having to constantly blather at them and then eventually hoping that something gets sticky enough. No, do it on purpose. And the final thing that I'm going to mention, because there's just a lot of substance to this, but is that decision-making happens in the limbic system of the brain. And the limbic system controls emotion, does not control communication, and it does not control logic. And so for any of our B2B listeners, which all of them should be because this is what we specialize in, if they're like, what? No, no, logic. No, no, no. Logic starts to go into that confirmation bias. The subconscious is contextualizing everything we've ever experienced and making a gut decision. It's pre-deciding what it's going towards. And then it moves to a different part of the brain, moves that information to wrap communication and logic around it. So when it comes out of our mouth to someone else, where we're gifting somebody with our thoughts, now we are trying to explain what we realized in our gut. So it's a process, happens just like this, but all purchasing is emotional. All purchasing is emotional. And if you keep that landscape out, you're really cutting off what is the buyer really buying. Because let's be honest, no one ever bought software because they wanted to buy software. Never. Some people are buying it because they're early adopters and they think it's cool, but it probably represents a competitive advantage. And so then it's firing up that win or that innovator or that self-identity, you know, belief about what they have. Or other people are trying to buy efficiency, right? We need to get increased speed to market, or my team is driving me crazy. I need more data and more tracking, and I need to really understand why we're having some problems. And so they're buying software in order to increase visibility that's happening between the humans in their organization. Behind every single one of those decisions and the myriad behind it, there's an emotion. Taking somebody off, stressing them out, making them hopeful or excited, but it's tapping into something that is a significant and important reality for them. And that reality is emotional. And so I just get excited about this because it's better to have the real conversation. What does this represent to you in your career? What is this holding you back from? What's possible if you progress, right? And I don't mean manipulative questioning tactics. I mean honest to God, real conversations where, God forbid, if you get into that point in the conversation, you realize this isn't good for this buyer, like we're not the right, that you would have the integrity to tell the truth and progress them, because you just created a raving fan if you did that. But for everyone that's not your ideal, if you did the buyer personas, almost all of the rest of them are going to be, and they're going to get it so much faster if you're speaking to them in a way that they can receive that information. And that's psychology. And it's like playing football, not knowing the game, right? You know, like bringing a bat like onto a football field. Nope, that's not the game we're playing. And I feel like a lot of business-to-business companies are doing that to themselves because they don't really understand the real landscape and the real rules of the game when there's a war on attention happening around our communication. So
this really leads us into our next topic, because a lot of people, when they're talking about marketing and sales together, lead generation, yeah, tactics. But you're talking about tapping into the emotions, creating wow factor, giving people a reason to pay attention. And that is not lead generation, that is branding.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what branding is. So let's explore that question in the context of your book. What is branding? Branding is the art of aligning with and directing people's emotions and opinions on the conscious and subconscious levels. Your brand is not how you view your company, it's how outsiders view your company. A truly amazing brand sits at the intersection of its incomparable advantage and what its customers care about. I mean, branding is not a logo,
exactly,
or a website.
Exactly. Do you know this was the hardest chapter in the book to write? Because there's so much said about branding, but there's also so much murkiness, especially in B2B. So what? Pretty pictures, pretty words. So what? That doesn't apply in my world. Okay, well, let's change the language. What sells for you when you're not in the room? When they're going through that 90% of research, what's impressing upon them and reflecting your reputation and your relevance and your expertise? If you look mom and pop and you're in technology, careful that 20-year-old website's not hurting you. I would argue that it is, right? Or if you're in an environment where you sell to enterprise clients and you sell to buyers that are constantly inundated with the best of the best, the most beautiful, the most effective, and you have not taken any ownership and stewardship of your visual communication. Wow. We even have packages where for certain clients, because of that very prestigious environment where prestige is a fascination trigger, we really are saying to them, no, you don't understand. These are table stakes. Like, looking the best, looking premier is table stakes. Everything else makes you look bottom tier, no matter how good you are. So you know, that representation. But then it has such a huge impact on your team, right? It's like that badge of honor where you're like, that's what we stand for. That's who we are. And goes back to psychology. Branding is primarily visual communication, but it's everything. You know, if you use sounds, if you use taglines, you know, mnemonic devices, customer experience, the tone, the voice, how do people answer the phone? What do they expect from you? Some clients can swear in their copy. Some clients would get crucified if they did, right? So making those decisions ahead of time so everything's consistent invites them into a relationship with your organization, where they won't remember, did I talk to a salesperson? Did I get that from marketing? Did I hear about that from a referral partner? Because there's such consistency across that culture and across how you serve people that by the time they do have a live conversation, they're like, I just love these guys. It's not that guy. It's not the one person. But it creates this halo effect for your entire team and sets people up for success because they already have a belief. Because even if people are not stewarding their brand, we internally We even call our branding workshop our truth workshop, because you already have a brand perception. You're just not in control of it, right? And so, yeah, in the book, I mean, I took a lot of time to organize the marketing jargon around branding and to get some basic building blocks of what is a brand, how do you build one, how do you steward one that's authentic to who you are. But the eyes process information 60,000 times faster than any other sensory. So if you're relying on your messaging to be verbally communicated through sales process, not only are you cutting off 80% of the marketing tactics out there in the buyer's journey, but also you're killing the most effective communication strategy, because the eyes believe, you know, the brain believes what the eyes see, right? That is not a cliche. That is true. It's literally how we're wired. So yeah, branding is important. And I think we've said it enough at this point that we love revenue. Like, we are revenue first. Marketing should drive revenue. It should drive reputation. It should drive resilience, right? We're all about return on investment. So there are times when we do not recommend branding or website or visual communication as the very first thing that we do. But there is never a point in time where we should not at least be having that conversation and prioritizing it appropriately, because eventually it's what greases the wheels. It's what increases value in your company and valuation in your company. It's what makes selling faster and easier. It's what sets the table so that you're the one to beat, not you're the one that has to fight as an underdog. So if you want to increase that return on investment long-term, which you should, because we're building a system, brand is a non-negotiable part of an amazing business development system, period.
So branding is one of the most confusing and poorly understood aspects of marketing. Yep. But the other one is budgeting and ROI. So that's where we're going to go next. Hard right turn. Budgeting and ROI are two sides of the same coin. You must make informed decisions about where to put your money, time, and attention, and then you must measure the effectiveness of those tactics to find areas of improvement or redirection. Sounds simple. Oh my gosh, people get so confused when it comes to how much should I spend on marketing and how do I know that I'm getting what I should be getting from it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this goes back first to ecosystem and system, right? So while we pay attention to data for individual tactics, we want to pay attention to your total system spend and your total revenue acceleration. And have those conversations we mentioned earlier about breaking down the number and understanding. Now, once you start breaking down the number, once you start having buyer personas as decision-making criteria, once you map your sales cycle, you start to ask yourself, well, where's the problem? What problem do we need to solve first? So first and foremost, and I will answer how much do we need to spend on budget, on marketing and for budgeting. But first and foremost, what we see a lot of times is people buy into their marketing plan and then they never back up and realign the budget to the marketing plan. So they say, yes, all that sales enablement that you're doing, yes, we absolutely agree. That's what we need to do. That digital marketing that you were recommending that we turn on, yes, we agree. We understand the rationale. We understand the numbers. And then they still spend 70% on, you know, customer support and trade shows. So they never rearranged the numbers. They didn't pull in the CFO. They didn't pull in the head of sales. They didn't look at their total budget as a growth budget. They didn't do the numbers at all when it came to the dollars, right? So people always think it's additive. So that's important. And then to speak specifically to budget, I mean, it's funny. Since writing this book, we internally have really gone on a journey to get better at this and to serve clients better. So generally speaking, people say, okay, you should be spending about 10% of your gross revenue on marketing. Now, for anybody there listening that just freaked out, you probably should. If you're in professional services, that's probably a pretty realistic number. Depending on your competition, it might be lower, might be higher if you're earlier in your company's journey and you're trying to get some traction. But for companies that have high levels of inventory where their gross margins are much lower, that's a totally different conversation, right? So we've started having some financial conversations on twofolds to understand gross margins. So now we know the real numbers, not the top line number, but the real number, what they have to work with, breaking down that number so that we understand, is there hidden churn? Are there hidden problems with their revenue strategy that we can fix without a lot of spend? And then assessing return on investment, you know, average price per deal, what is a reasonable, and just what's the reality? So we literally have a real conversation. We're taking real numbers and organizing that. And then we go back and match the numbers to the plan. Sometimes you can't do everything you want to do. That's all right. Have the right conversation, set appropriate expectations, plan to reinvest, right? But have that real conversation. I mean, budgeting is an art and a science. Because the final thing that I'll say is there is always hidden money. And I'm not being cute. I mean, most people think, okay, there's marketing, you know, in the P&L. There's a line item. Is there though? Because here's what we find when we're going through that conversation. Well, how much did you spend on travel? A lot of times people don't name trade show expenditures as marketing. It's hidden in other places, right? All right, well, how much did you pay for tchotchkes? How much did you pay for printing? How much did you pay for those banners? Oftentimes, we are seeing tens of thousands of dollars on stuff that nobody expects to have any return on investment. I'm like, stop buying people squishy balls. Good God, you know, find the dollars, client delight. How often are you how often are you spending on events? There's so many things that a CMO regards as marketing, but it's hidden in that P&L. And so we hear people all the time go, we have never spent a dollar in marketing. Oh, yes, right? That laugh. Au contraire, I have never met a company that has literally spent zero on marketing. They're just using different semantics. So when we do an intake, controllers love us for this when they have to go digging through that. But even if it's an estimate, right? Like, we don't have to have perfect numbers. If we can estimate trade show, estimate travel, estimate expenditure on physical things and on all of the video services or anything that you didn't technically label as marketing when you were entering that in your accounting. Just estimate, holy cow, typically that's a reasonably healthy marketing budget to at least start and start allocating appropriately because you do have a growth budget. And we do want to know how much are you spending on salaries or compensation. I mean, and just to have the real conversation, because that entire spend should be relative to the entire growth budget, not, oh, just this little part of marketing, the one person compared to the 30 is responsible for this big number and we just kind of murk our way through the rest of it. Not true. So I think while it's not a 1+1=2 conversation, I don't really like that 10% allocation, just boom, because everybody's in a different financial scenario. There's some pretty straightforward, reasonable conversations, you know, in a single morning that you can have that can get you to some really good answers. And just start there and just keep moving forward and, you know, and match it to what's realistic.
One of the things I really do love is our tools and our frameworks at Blender, because it makes those conversations finally make sense. It's not fuzzy anymore. It's in black and white. You can evaluate it. You're making decisions. You know, if they're spending money on the squishy balls and it's not helping them grow revenue, okay, Maybe it's okay to stop spending money, as you said earlier, on things that just aren't giving you the results that you need. Exactly. So the final section that I want to talk about is alignment. And this is, you know, sales and marketing alignment, but also the entire organization has to be moving toward the same goals. Alignment is critical. When your organization aligns around common frameworks, goals, and values, opportunities open up for you to have greater impact. So you shared a ton of frameworks in the book itself, and that's honestly scratching the surface of all the frameworks that we have available for B2B. Exactly. We have a lot, and every single one of them is aimed at solving a problem that B2B companies come to us with all the time. Yep. So what happens, what's the outcome for companies that have the kind of alignment that you're talking about in the book?
Oh my gosh. I mean, the statistics around marketing and sales alignment and organizational alignment are shocking. I mean, they're so big that even if I could just rattle them off the head, I wouldn't, because people wouldn't believe me. You guys can look them up in the book, of course, but that's such a big, big deal. But let me just break it down to where different points of impact. Now, obviously, we've already covered accelerated growth and sustainable acceleration. So when you build a system, you can do that. It builds resilience, because if you're building a system, you'll see the data that if an algorithm is changing or a disruptor is coming into the market or pricing is changing, marketing is in the perfect seat to actually harvest those insights. Innovation, like being able to bring massive value and practical innovation to the market. Oftentimes, if we're taking voice of the customer and really paying attention to those buyer personas, it's amazing how you can operationalize marketing insights and continue to gain competitive advantage. We do collaborations now, which are so exciting, around employer branding and talent attraction. No, Indeed is not the only thing, and not the only way you can reach the market. So building and working with HR teams and recruiting firms to build something amazing that then, again, just nourishes and enriches culture. Internal communication to reduce employee churn is a huge one. People really understanding, I mean, their scalability for across all of these systems. We've talked about budgeting, so we're talking about maximizing our marketing spend, reducing and maximizing the results. And then once we have a system, accelerating that, because we're creating forecastability. I could go on and on. I think one of the biggest things, though, that we're talking about is that this is about building a company of excellence, not a marketing department of excellence, but these are all attributes of high-performing companies. And so that builds valuation. So whether you're going to exit or not, it sets up the next year and the following year and even the next generation of leadership for success, because you're stewarding the communication that literally is the glue for everything that you accomplish. So many places to harvest realized financial impact. I mean, where you can physically see it on your P&L and on your balance sheet and in your multipliers, very, very exciting. And it just feels amazing to get to work with companies and leaders where they go through this transformation, where marketing is a frustration, where they wish it away, to, wow, this really represents everything we stand for in the world. And what the value we really bring to humans and the excellence that we work so hard for. And it starts to just bring all of those visions to life. It is magic to watch people and like their hearts transform where their work is being honored in the world. So that might have felt like a soapbox, but I get so excited about how important this is and what it stands for, because it's not just soft benefit. I mean, there's so much substantial value created when you decide to think about marketing, capital M marketing, not little M marketing, around a massive tool of value that you can literally start to leverage right now, not someday. So, yeah.
That's outstanding. So everyone, final note, corporate caffeine. If you want to make impact with your organization, if you want to hit your goals for revenue, reputation, and resilience, this is the book you'll want to read. Also, make sure to continue watching us here at the Marketing Blender Show. Hit the like and subscribe buttons so that you get all of our latest content. We never stop learning and growing, and we never stop sharing.
Onward and upward.